From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, using a vivid imagination to get by during the Depression, we talk with writer A.E. Hotchner about his childhood. To fight off hunger, he would chew on magazine pictures of pot roasts and corn on the cob. Hotchner's memoir of his childhood was made into the film King of the Hill, which has just come out on videotape. Also, setting up a train crash, we talk with film director Andrew Davis about shooting the famous train crash scene in his movie The Fugitive. The film has received 7 Academy Award nominations, including one for Best Picture. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bill Radlin. The Prime Ministers of Britain and Ireland say they will carry on with their peace initiatives for Northern Ireland, despite 2 separate mortar attacks on London's Heathrow Airport, believed to be the work of the Irish Republican Army. From London, NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
In a joint statement, British Prime Minister John Major and his Irish counterpart Albert Reynolds declared that their initiative to bring peace to Northern Ireland will not be derailed by violence. The two leaders said they would push ahead with efforts to bring democratic change to the mostly Protestant republic, and, quote, there is nothing the men of violence can do to deflect us from it. The 2 mortar attacks on Heathrow came on Wednesday and Thursday nights. In each, 4 bombs landed inside the airport grounds near runways, but none of the devices exploded. Members of Parliament are now raising angry questions about the state of security at one of the world's busiest airports. They want to know why a plane carrying the Queen of England was allowed to land Thursday night after authorities received phone threats of the second bomb attack, an attack that came less than 3 hours later. I'm Andy Bowers in London.
A show of force by Israeli police kept things quiet in Jerusalem on the Muslim Sabbath. Officials were concerned since it was the 2-week anniversary of the attack on a West Bank mosque and since it's near the end of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. 1,800 police were on hand in Jerusalem's old walled city. Jewish settlers going to the Western Wall had to check their weapons. The police allowed Arabs to enter the area only through gates that lead to the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The only violence reported occurred later in East Jerusalem, where Israeli radio said police fired rubber bullets to break up a group of rioting Arab youths. The wife of France's socialist president, François Mitterrand, has resigned from a National Commission on Human Rights. She's accused the conservative government, which shares power with her husband, of eroding the rights of immigrants. Lynn Terry reports.
The president's wife, Danielle Mitterrand, said in a letter to the commission that mistrust and suspicion against immigrants is growing in France. She suggested the government is to blame. She complained in a letter about a series of measures passed in the last few months, restricting the rights of foreigners to enter and stay here. She said the laws had undermined the rights of French people to marry foreigners and the rights of refugees to seek asylum in France. Madame Mitterrand is the leader of the human rights group France Liberté. She was among 70 members of the commission, which was created in 1984 to advise the government on human rights. She said her objections to the government's immigration policies had gone unnoticed. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General John Shalikashvili left Washington for Somalia today to praise the departing American troops there for their, as he put it, extraordinarily noble undertaking in fighting hunger. But he also noted the bitter lesson that such a mission can turn into a small-scale war and cost American lives. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up over 21 points. This is NPR News in Washington. Senate Republican leader Bob Dole says 2 top officials in the Clinton administration should be put on unpaid leave. Dole says Deputy Treasury Secretary Roger Altman and Associate Attorney General Webster Hubbell should be, in his words, out of the picture. Altman recently revealed that Treasury officials told the White House about investigations into a failed Arkansas savings and loan, which had ties to the Clintons' Whitewater land deal. Hubbell worked at the Rose Law Firm in Little Rock, which represented the thrift. The Commerce Department says U.S. companies are being given greater leeway to sell satellite photos and remote imaging systems. NPR's Doreen McAllister reports.
The global market for satellite photos stands at $400 million, and U.S. companies want a bigger share of it. By the turn of the century, it's estimated that the market will be worth billions of dollars. But some believe U.S. companies have been held back because the Defense Department and the CIA are wary of giving away government secrets. But a Commerce Department spokesman says specific conditions would be imposed to protect national security and international obligations. Satellite photos have a variety of uses, including discovery of oil and tracking pollution. A French corporation has been selling satellite pictures that can capture objects as small as 30 to 60 feet in length, and a Russian firm is marketing images in the United States with 6-foot resolution. I'm Doreen McAllister in Washington.
Massachusetts' highest court has upheld a lower court ruling allowing the Irish-American gay, lesbian, and bisexual group of Boston to take part in the city's St. Patrick's Day parade. However, the South Boston Allied War Veterans Council, which has run the parade since 1947, has threatened to pull out if it is forced to allow homosexuals to take part. City officials say it's not clear if the city will step in if the Veterans Council throws in the towel. Last year, police in riot gear escorted gay and lesbian marchers in the parade. I'm Bill Radlin, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain. It's a classic American story. A kid in St. Louis during the Depression, living hand-to-mouth in a flop house, grows up to become friends with the celebrity elite. Well, that's pretty close to the real-life story of my guest, writer A.E. Hotchner. After serving in the Air Force during the Second World War, Hotchner wrote for Cosmopolitan magazine, where it was his job to profile the famous people of the day. It was the beginning of a writing career that got him close to well-known literary and Hollywood figures, people like Clark Gable, J.D. Salinger, Tennessee Williams, and Ingrid Bergman, to name a few. He also wrote biographies of Sophia Loren and Doris Day. His book, Papa Hemingway, was a bestseller. But it's the book he wrote 20 years ago about himself and his family's struggle during the Depression that's the subject of a recent film called King of the Hill. I spoke with Hotchner last summer after the film came out. This week, King of the Hill is being released on videotape. The film is set in St. Louis, in the transient hotel where Hotchner and his family lived. He spent nearly 2 months alone in this hotel when he was 12. Hotchner told me that, like many families in the 30s, his family was hit hard by the tough economic times. I asked him what his life was like before the Depression.
Well, we were a very solid middle-class family. My father had a fur business. St. Louis was a fur hub. He was doing fairly well. We lived comfortably. We were pretty much toward the middle of the families of St. Louis. He had all of his money in one bank, the Night and Day Bank, which went under. There was no deposit insurance in those days, and I think he got paid one penny on a dollar, and that destroyed any fabric he had in the business world. And from then on, it was a spiral downhill. The net result of it was that we had to leave where we were living. We went into progressively less attractive places. And in the summer of 1933, which is when the book delineates my life, and that's what the movie's about, we had wound up in a really seedy hotel in a bad section of St. Louis, a hotel that had a taxi dance hall in the basement, prostitutes on the first floor who worked the dance hall. It was a real flea bag of a hotel.
How did your parents' worries, anxieties about making money and about their future affect you as a kid?
Well, I think you realize, not only because of your parents' anxieties, but because of the anxieties on the streets and what had happened to everybody around you, that you were in a calamitous situation. But what I think is not realized is that what is insurmountable for an adult, they look at a world in which things are in smoking ruins, in which people aren't eating, in which there seems to be no hope for getting a job. They look at it differently than a 12-year-old boy who always sees some kind of a possibility of getting around whatever the obstacle is. At least that was my attitude.
Well, you seem to be a very resourceful young boy. I was wondering whether your parents had raised you to be that way, or whether there was something about the circumstances that really forced you to be so grown up and to be so resourceful.
I think it's the circumstances. As a matter of fact, my family were they were conservative. They didn't take risks. They were. My father was a European. My mother had been born in this country, but into a family of immigrants. So these were conservative people who didn't take risks and who tried to abide by very orderly by the laws and the rules. So that whatever I did in the way of inventing a life for myself, and whatever imagination motivated me, and whatever motivated that world that I created for myself, had to be something that was peculiar to me. I can't believe that we had any of those elements in the house at the time.
Your imagination was really your key to survival. You were able to spin out an imaginary life for yourself.
One thing was, I even had an overall pretense in my mind, and I really accepted it, that my parents were really wealthy, and that this was just a momentary lapse during which they wanted me to see how it was to live poor, and that at any moment they would say, okay, Aaron, that's enough. Now we can go live in our real house, which is out there in the suburbs, and it's terrific, and you've got a big backyard with a basketball hoop. So I just persisted in that delusion, and it really did stand me in very good stead. I had a lot of other delusions, but that was the main one.
What does it take to believe a delusion like that when your world is so clearly a very harsh world, and the world of your imagination is so lush in comparison?
Well, one motivating factor, I think, was the fact that I read prodigious amounts of books, and the books were all books of fantasy. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and all the rest of the books. I particularly like French authors. So I sort of dwelt in a world of imagination anyway in these books. I think that I just bridged whatever I was reading into the life I was leading. And I could very often pretend that I was something that I wasn't. I could walk down the street and decide that I was really D'Artagnan, one of the musketeers. And I'd have an old piece of hickory twig, and that was my sword. So the pretense and the imagination and the make-believe is what gets you over the fact that you haven't eaten in a day and a half, and that you're hungry, and that your clothes are wearing through and your kids are all busted up. But nevertheless, you pretend that it's a world that is satisfactory to you, that you're really part of something else.
Well, I want to play a clip from the movie, but let me first just describe what's happened to you as we get to this part of the movie. Your mother is sick. She's taken to a sanitarium. Your brother has been sent away to live with relatives because your parents couldn't afford for him to live with you. Your father is leaving to sell watches, and this is finally a job where he believes he can actually make some money. But you are left alone at the age of 12. And let me just play this clip.
Listen to me, Aaron. You're going to be okay. You're a smart boy. You're very smart. I tell you how smart you are. Once when you were less than a year old, your mother was in a sanitarium with consumption, and you would cry every night. So the first few times I picked you up and you stopped crying, so I realized you just wanted attention. So the next time you cried, I got a glass of cold water, and I stood over the crib, and I said, you see this? This is a glass of cold water, so you better stop crying or you'll be sorry. But you kept crying, so I poured the cold water in your face, and you stopped crying just like that. And from then on, when you cried, all I had to do was to show you the glass of water and you'd stop crying. Now that's a smart baby for you, eh?
Did your father say that to you?
More than once, all through my boyhood, when people would come to visit, my father would trot out that story about how smart I was, that all he had to do was show me that glass of ice water, and that I would stop talking and stop crying. It's his variation on Pavlov's dog.
Right.
And I think that that story and others of my father, his insensitivity to the problems I would have, leaving me alone and giving me 25 cents or 50 cents and a kind of a promise that the guy at the cafeteria was going to give me some food, I think that ruptured any possible relationship I could have with my father after that, and I never did. But that story certainly was authentic. It was word for word the way he used to tell it, and he repeated it many times.
Let me ask you how you were able to survive on your own. Here you were, all by yourself, at the age of 12. Your father was off working, your mother is in the sanitarium. First of all, what did you do for money? You were only given, 25, 50 cents by your dad?
Well, I did nothing that would earn any money because there was no job. I mean, there were grown men all over the street who would do anything for 25 cents. They would work for a whole day for it. So it was impossible to earn any money. But I could walk to school. I had, with the 25 cents he left me, had been able to buy some food. Unlike the movie, the fact is that the man was there in the restaurant for a while until he left. So I got a few meals. And then at lunchtime at school, I, as it's depicted in the movie, I would watch the fat, plump, rich kids with their full pail of food, lunch pail. And when they would go away and run around the lunchroom a little bit, I would go over and filch a sandwich or two. And that sustained me. But as for money, that didn't exist. I just had to get along without it.
The movie ends, your memoir ends, your family is reunited. Fill us in, if you can, what happened after that? And your father actually was able to get a job.
Well, I wish that it had at all become a happy ending, because that's how it looked at the time that the book ends and as the movie ends. But reality, alas, is not the same as fiction. What happened was, my father really wasn't qualified for that job at the WPA, and it didn't last very long. So we were out of the decent apartment that we had and into a succession of grubby places that we had to go live, one worse than the other. There was one room that was next to a station that had fire engines, and they went out all times of the day and night, and it sounded like they were coming right through the room that we were sleeping in. We really had a rather difficult time of it, right up to the time that I went to college. I finally got scholarships and scrounged my way and got a little job and got myself to Washington University. But it was never a very rewarding life until I finally got out of university and practiced law for a couple of years before I went into the Air Force. But it was a long haul, this struggle.
We just have to take a short break. My guest is writer A.E. Hotchner, and filmmaker Steven Soderbergh has made a movie about my guest's childhood. The movie is called King of the Hill, and it's based on my guest's memoir of the same name. A.E. Hotchner is known for his biographies, including the bestseller Papa Hemingway. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer A.E. Hotchner. Let's make a leap in time if we can. And certainly you've made a name for yourself as someone who's written a number of biographies, including the biography of Sophia Loren, Doris Day, Ernest Hemingway. How did you become interested in the lives of these famous people?
Well, it wasn't anything that I had planned or was deliberate. When I finally got out of the Air Force, I decided to stay in Paris. I had wound up on Air Force Magazine as a major and running their bureau and having a fine time, so I got discharged. By the time I got back, there were no jobs left. And a friend of mine had become editor of Cosmopolitan. It was then a literary magazine before Helen Gurley Brown brought in Sex and the Single Girl. The only job he had for me was to become what I would think of as a literary bounty hunter. He gave me a list of 20 writers who had once written for the magazine, but weren't writing for them anymore, he paid my expenses to go see them. If I got them to write something, I was paid a fee. That was the bounty. Mm. So in that way, I got to meet Edna Ferber and Dorothy Parker and became great friends with them over the years. And other people, Steinbeck. The last on the list I tried to avoid was Hemingway, but he forced me to go down to Havana. And as I recount in Papa Hemingway, I sent him a note just saying, "Dear Mr. Hemingway, I'm down here on this ridiculous assignment. If you just send me a note saying, go fly a kite, then I can go back and say, look, I tried to get him." Instead, he called me and said, "Come on, have a drink at the Floridita." And he did, and the drink lasted about 4 hours. And the next day, he took me out in the boat, and I became really a pal of his as a result of that initial visit.
What do you think he saw in you?
I think he saw in me the son that he didn't have with the three sons he had. Now, that might sound a little bit strange, but at the time that I went down to Cuba, I was young, I was just out of the Air Force. He never really connected with the three sons he has. It may be that because of the divorces, they were with their mother. I don't know why. He always had problems with them. With me, he had none of those. I was sort of born afresh with him. So he took great pleasure in teaching me things. And I, God knows, didn't know anything. So I was a perfect receiver for that. So he taught me how to deep sea fish, how to shoot game in Idaho, how to understand and appreciate the bullfight. He even, taking it to a terrible extreme, on one occasion maneuvered me to go into the ring with the two greatest bullfighters in the world, Domenguin and Antonio Ordonez.
How'd you do?
I survived. I mean, that was as harrowing as life gets. But all of those things, I think another factor was that, as I told you, I lived this unreal kind of existence. So I saw soon after I had contacted him, and I went to Paris with him because he was finishing the book that he was writing for himself, but Cosmopolitan was going to publish it. I said to myself, "Now this is a fine life. Look at that. He doesn't work for anybody. He just goes where he wants to go. He writes a little bit." And I immediately resigned my job. It didn't occur to me, having only about $180 in the bank, that it wouldn't quite be as easy for me to get along as it was for Ernest Hemingway. But as it was life in the hotel, it just never seemed to me an obstacle. So I immediately set about trying to get assignments for magazines, and I got a couple and built on that. That made me available to go anywhere that he wanted to go. I had no job. I had nothing that I had to punch a clock for. So when Ernest said, "Why don't you come out to catch him and we'll shoot some pheasant," I went. When he said, "Why don't you, I've had a terrible crash in Africa and I've come back to Venice in Europe and Amsterdam," and I was doing an article about a soothsayer that the Queen of Holland was using to guide her affairs. He said, "Why don't you come down to Venice and we'll drive to Madrid together and we'll talk about things." So I was available. So that's really part of it too.
Did he read your writing?
Yes, he did. And he also saw every one of the television adaptations that I made. At first I said, "Would you like to see the scripts after I do them?" We did talk about the background. He said, "Nope, I don't want to see any scripts. I'll look at the shows, and if they're good, that's fine." I said, "What if they're not?" He said, "That's not fine." So thank goodness he never really objected. But on one trip that we took, I was driving Ernest and Mary, along with them, I was doing the driving, from Ketchum, we were going to Key West. And he knew that the first part of Whom the Bell Tolls, which I had done for Playhouse 90, there were 2 hour-and-a-half segments. It was going to be on television. And I was hoping he would forget it, but he remembered. And we went into a motel in Arizona, I believe, somewhere. Some little out-of-the-way place, and they only had one big television set in the lobby, and it had rabbit ears on it. So Hemingway had it brought up to his room, and we tuned it in. Well, the only way the set would work would be if somebody held one of the rabbit ears. For some reason, human contact made the picture come in. So he said, "Well, look, Hotch, you've seen this. You know about it. You made it. Why don't you just sit there beside the set and hold the rabbit ear, and Mary and I'll get up here on the bed, and we'll watch it." And that's as sweaty as I ever got, with him watching For Whom the Bell Tolls while I sat there holding the rabbit ear.
And watching him, watching what you'd done.
That's what I looked at. I couldn't see the screen.
What did he teach you about drinking?
He taught me to drink. The first time I met him, he called a hotel. I was staying at the Nacional. And the phone rang, and this voice says, "Hotchner, Hemingway here." He said, "Got your note about how if I don't answer you, they might fire you." And he said, "You're working for Hearst?" He said, "God, working for Hearst? I mean, if he got fired there, it'd be like getting kicked out of a leper colony." He said, "Come meet me, have a drink at the Floridita." So that was how I met him, at the Floridita. And he was drinking a concoction called a Papa Doble. It was a daiquiri that was served in a vase that could have held long-stem roses. So I drank. It was a very pleasant drink. I had never drunk much, maybe not at all at that point. And it was a very fine-tasting concoction, lime juice and something else in there. And we got onto the second one, and I handled that all right. But after that, I don't have much memory of the rest of that evening. But from then on, Hemingway was a very tolerant fellow about drinking. He didn't say, "Drink up and let's have another drink," ever. He drank at his pace and you drank at yours. But one thing that I really found difficult, when we go out in the boat, it'd be 6 o'clock in the morning, and he'd go up on the top deck where he had a set of controls that he used for steering the boat. Underneath it was an ice box that you sat on. So he would open it up, take out a ice-encrusted bottle of tequila, and pour you 3 fingers of that, put a little salt on our hands, and Donna would go, "That was pretty tough in the morning." But that's just part of the ritual, and I got to enjoy it, but I never really drank very much, and he didn't really made no demands. He sometimes would like to drink Pernod, which is a polite form of absinthe, and I would have a beer, and that was fine. It was never imposed.
You describe your very close relationship with Ernest Hemingway and the fact that you really looked up to him the whole time that you knew him. What is it like to try to write a biography about someone who you admire so much?
It wasn't a biography. It was a memoir. I only wrote about those years that I knew him. It's a very personal account of what we did and where we went and what he had to say. About his, a good deal of it's about his past. So in that sense, it's a biography. Ernest was a marvelous raconteur. He spoke as well as he wrote. So very often we'd be in Paris, and I remember one occasion we walked up to Montmartre. We walked around Montmartre, and he began to reminisce about that place or this place and what happened there. He would be reminded, we passed a place, he said, "Oh, down there in the basement was Le Jockey, the best nightclub I was ever in, and that's where I met whoever." I think he told me he first saw Fitzgerald there. I know who it was. It was Josephine Baker. That one of the times he was there, there was this tall, wildly attractive woman. It was July, a real heat wave in Paris, and she was dancing in a fur coat with a British subaltern, and he was absolutely fascinated, this gorgeous woman, so he cut in. And that was the beginning of his, the years of his relationship with Josephine Baker. So, I mean, in the course of being with him, I was told about the past and told about the present and told about people and told about bullfighters and had a wonderful running commentary on life.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us today and talking to us about your life.
It was fine visiting with you.
Writer A.E. Hotchner, King of the Hill, has just been released on videotape. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowain with Fresh Air. People tell film director Andrew Davis that their fingers go numb when they watch one of his movies, from gripping the seat so hard. Coming up, we talk with the director of the action films Under Siege, Code of Silence, and The Fugitive, which has been nominated for an Academy Award for Best Picture. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews a new screen adaptation of Joseph Conrad's novel, Heart of Darkness, which premieres this Sunday on the TNT cable network. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Sam Phillips' latest release, Martinis and Bikinis. That's all coming up on today's edition of Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bill Radlin. The House passed a $1.51 trillion budget today that endorses the president's plans to cut defense and many domestic programs enough to produce the smallest deficit in 6 years. It was approved on a near party-line vote of 223 to 175. The Senate Budget Committee will begin writing its own version of the plan next week. Republicans offered an alternative package. It was rejected 243 to 165. President Clinton announced today that he would be the host of a Summit of the Americas in Miami this December, NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The heads of all the countries in the hemisphere except Cuba are invited to attend. The exiled president of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, will be invited, but the military ruler of Haiti, Lieutenant General Raoul Cedras, will not. The purpose of the meeting is to talk about how to solidify democracy and free trade throughout the region. It would be the first such meeting since 1967. The president said Miami was chosen for the summit because its economy was fully integrated with the economies of Latin America and the Caribbean. But boosting the re-election chances of Democratic Governor Lawton Childs and the president himself also seem to be reasons. Clinton lost Florida to George Bush in the presidential election of 1992. Childs said today the hemispheric summit will help Clinton carry the state in 1996. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
The number of new AIDS cases more than doubled last year under a broader definition of the disease. The Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention had projected the number of new AIDS cases would jump by 75% in 1993, the first year of the new definition. However, it actually increased by 111%. A small but increasing number of the new cases, 9%, were from heterosexual transmission. The crew of the space shuttle Columbia has reached the halfway point in its mission. Mission Control awakened the astronauts this morning with the rock oldie taking care of business. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
Columbia's five astronauts have been working in space for 8 days now and still have another week's worth of scientific research ahead of them. NASA says the mission's 11 major science experiments to this point have exceeded expectations. One of the primary objectives of this flight is to study how humans adapt to long periods of near weightlessness. Each day, the crew submit themselves to biomedical experiments. In addition, scientists are keeping tabs on the 16 rats that are flying aboard the shuttle. They will study how their immune and skeletal systems react in space. The high point of the mission for pilot Andy Allen may have come yesterday. Allen is a member of the Marine Corps and was promoted from major to lieutenant colonel. Research continues today on how materials used to build a space station react in orbit. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
On Wall Street, stocks closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrials gained 32.08 points to close at 3862.70. This is NPR News in Washington. Thousands of armed white extremists pulled out of Botswana's homeland's main air base minutes before South African troops moved through the capital. About 5,000 of the right-wingers had surged into the capital early today, saying they were there to defend homeland ruler Lucas Mangope against an uprising they said was fomented by the African National Congress. Earlier in the day, fighting broke out between homeland soldiers and the White Ring Force. Three whites were killed in the confrontation. The Russian government has decided to drop all charges against a scientist who was accused of revealing state secrets when he disclosed the existence of a new Russian chemical weapons program. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
The secret trial of chemist Vil Mirzayanov came to a halt several weeks ago, and the Russian court sent the case back to the prosecutor general for more investigation. Today, the prosecutor admitted there was no case against the whistleblowing scientist, that he had not disclosed state secrets in articles he published in 1992. At that time, Mirzayanov revealed that despite Moscow's adherence to an international treaty pledging it to terminate its chemical weapons program, the Russian military was developing new chemical weapons. His trial began earlier this year in secret, despite a ban on such trials in the newly adopted Russian constitution. Mirzayanov refused to participate and was arrested. Even when the court sent the case back for further investigation, the scientist was kept in prison for a week without any legal justification. Mirzayanov said today he was satisfied with the outcome. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
The Pentagon says Defense Secretary William Perry will visit Russia, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, and Belarus starting next Thursday to discuss military and other ties with the former Soviet republics. His visit to Moscow will be the first by a top administration cabinet official since the February 21st arrest of veteran CIA officer Aldrich Ames on charges he sold U.S. secrets to Moscow. Despite Washington's official anger over the case, President Clinton has said he will maintain close ties with the government of President Boris Yeltsin. I'm Bill Redlin, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. On her first two albums, the singer and songwriter Sam Phillips established herself as a cult star, prone to quirky melodies and off-kilter, often abstract lyrics. On her new release, Martinis and Bikinis, Phillips is making more accessible music, drawing from an obvious, if unexpected, source. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this review.
We don't want lives of steel. We don't want hearts that feel. We want to live above it all. I feel you closing in, a target on my skin. I think you'll be there when I fall.
Somehow, even when Sam Phillips is singing about a secure relationship, as she is there on When I Fall, she sounds full of foreboding and dread. This is actually one of her most attractive traits. It gives her music a constant tension and release. And it works the other way. When she's being needy and vulnerable, there's an underlying strength supporting that vulnerability. You can hear this in the fuzzy assertiveness of her voice, the way she makes assertions as if they were apologies, and then gets angry at her own ambivalence.
My conscience like a crying child. Lock the doors behind me, put the pain on fire. Broken like a window, I assume my blindness now. And I need love, not some sentimental prison.
The other thing you should understand about Martinis and Bikinis is that it's practically an album-long homage to the Beatles. That song, I Need Love, summons up melody lines and the tone the Beatles achieved on Rubber Soul and Sgt. Pepper, but the lyrics are completely Phillips' own. What other rock singer has ever sung sentiments like, I need love, not some sentimental prison, I need God, not the political church? But then sometimes Phillips speaks much more directly to us, as on a song that sounds like an instant classic to me, called Baby I Can't Please You.
Baby I can't please you, I can't please you. Baby, baby, baby I can't please you, I can't please you. Baby, ooh. Every time you start to criticize, I can see the misery in your eyes. You say I make your pain, but you're trying to turn the blame.
Sam Phillips started her career as a gospel singer and shared an evangelical Christian faith with the man she married, the Texas-born, L.A.-based singer-songwriter T-Bone Burnett. Burnett has produced Martinis and Bikinis, and the music has much of the Bob Dylan-derived wordiness and aimless expansiveness that characterizes his own records. But Sam Phillips gives a shape and purpose to her music that is beyond Burnett. Just a line in Baby I Can't Please You like, "You say love when you mean control," opens up a whole world of ideas and arguments. Like few other performers who claim to be after the truth, Sam Phillips actually seems to have a handle on it.
Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded little critics. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. Had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, big-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. We'll feature an interview with Sam Phillips on the next edition of our show. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane.
Listen up, ladies and gentlemen. Our fugitive has been on the run for 90 minutes. Average foot speed over uneven ground, barring injury, is 4 miles an hour. That gives us a radius of 6 miles. What I want out of each and every one of you is a hard target search of every gas station, residence, warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, and doghouse in that area. Checkpoints go up at 15 miles. Your fugitive's name is Dr. Richard Kimball. Go get him.
They got him. And last summer's hit film, The Fugitive, got 7 Academy Award nominations, including Best Picture and Best Supporting Actor. The film's director, Andrew Davis, has earned a reputation as an accomplished director of intelligent action thrillers. He knows how to get your adrenaline going and stimulate your brain cells in one sitting. His hit movies include the Chuck Norris film Code of Silence, The Package with Gene Hackman, and the Steven Seagal films Above the Law and Under Siege. The Fugitive reworks the 60s TV show of the same name. Once again, Dr. Richard Kimball, played by Harrison Ford, is falsely accused of murdering his wife. He escapes from jail to clear his name and find his wife's real murderer, the one-armed man. And U.S. Marshal Sam Girard, played by Academy Award nominee Tommy Lee Jones, is in hot pursuit. I spoke with Andrew Davis last summer when the film was in the theaters. This week, it comes out on video. I asked him why he chose Harrison Ford to star as Dr. Kimball.
Harrison Ford chose me. So it was the other way around. I had just finished another movie called Under Siege, and I was expecting to take time off. And I got a phone call from Warner Brothers saying that Harrison had seen Under Siege and wanted me to meet with him and to have me direct this movie if the meeting went well. And it did.
What did you like about what he could bring to that character, Dr. Kimball?
Well, he had a great range. First of all, he was a very sophisticated vascular surgeon, which fit perfectly. He's a great everyman, so that people could identify with him in terms of this could happen to me. And the fact that his own movie mystique is such a heroic kind of guy who's in jeopardy was perfect to fit into this role.
Now, Sam Girard, who's the U.S. Marshal who's obsessed with tracking down Dr. Kimball, is played by Tommy Lee Jones. And you seem to have changed this character slightly. He seems to be less malevolent than the TV show. Were you interested in humanizing him?
Yeah, I think everybody was interested in getting rid of cliches. And to have the pursuer have dimension, because he's really not the bad guy.
No.
He's just the heat. He's the pulse. He's the pressure on Richard Kimball. and to give him some range as a human being, and to have people around him like his other marshals who could play off of him and with him, I felt was important.
There is a scene in the movie. It's a train crash. It crashes into the bus that is transporting Dr. Kimball to prison. And it's a spectacular scene, and my understanding is that it really happened, in that you used a real train and a real train wreck. Why did you want to do that?
Well, why not? I didn't want to animate Harrison Ford, and I didn't want to, you know, not shoot in Chicago. So we wanted to make everything real. There's just no way to duplicate that kind of reality. You can get close and you can trick people. But for the kind of coverage we wanted to have, it would have been very complicated. We, in fact, did do some special effects shots that are part of the sequence, but there was an incredible train crash of a freight train into a bus.
Now, where did you film this scene?
In North Carolina.
And it was the Smoky Mountain Railroad,
right?
Is that right?
Smoky, yes, that's right.
How did you find Dillsboro. How did you find this particular railroad?
Well, actually, we scouted in Illinois first, and we're looking in Missouri and Indiana. I think one of our location scouts found a book about independently owned railways and began getting on the phone. And it turned out there was a dam in North Carolina that we could use for another part of the chase, and a tunnel that all fit together, so it worked out quite well.
So someone called up and said, we want to film a train wreck. Can we use your train?
Well, actually, what we did is we sort of assembled our own train. We bought 7 or 8 different cars that were specifically decided by ourselves that we wanted to have. And we found an old locomotive that we were able to take the engine out of. It was a junker. And we, in fact, pushed one locomotive. And the locomotive that hit the bus was a real one, didn't get hurt at all.
Now, I understand that you had some 11 cameras going. Is that right? And obviously with this, it's one take and one take only.
I think it was closer to over 13 or 16 cameras by the time we put it all together. Yeah, it was one take only. That's correct. We had cranes there if we had to do a second take, but it wasn't necessary.
How much planning went into this particular scene?
Well, once we found the location, I would say about a month and a half worth of real work with grading the track and putting in certain trestles of our own and having the ability to have a track hidden under the dirt so the train, in fact, could start chasing Harrison, look like it's chasing Harrison.
Well, certainly most of your movies, and I probably should list them, Under Siege, The Package, Above the Law, Code of Silence, these are all pretty much action movies. What is satisfying about making these kinds of pictures?
Well, you know, I didn't start out to be an action director. I'd done a lot of that work as a cameraman. And I made a musical film, a little musical film called Stony Island, and then was hired to direct a movie by Chuck Norris, a Chuck Norris movie called Code of Silence. And it was successful. And people said, well, he can do that. Let's let him do another one and another one. The satisfying part is that you really get to use your talents as a director. It's very visual. There's a lot of characters, there's a lot of stuff going on, and you get to be a filmmaker. I've been able to get themes into these films that make the difference to me in terms of having some kind of social fabric, whether it be about police brutality or guns and drugs for arms and the end of the Cold War and the military-industrial complex and needing to have it continue. These are all themes that have gone on in films I've done, and I can get away with it because it makes them more real.
Hmm.
And it makes the characters grounded in a reality where you care about them more and the action doesn't seem cartoonish.
Is there an approach you have to filming violence? And I wouldn't say your films are necessarily violent, but there are some violent scenes. I know in Under Siege, the actor, Steven Seagal, thank you, he actually kind of rips the throat out of a guy that he's taking on. And I wonder how you think about and how you approach a scene like that.
Well, actually, working with Steven Seagal and those kinds of scenes, those are like oriental kind of, martial arts kind of techniques that he draws out of his background. And basically, I photograph them. I don't tell him how to do it. And that's not stuff that I'm really interested in. I'm much more interested in the movement of the movie and in the characters that are part of the story that fit into what's going on there. I'm not proud of that kind of stuff, and hopefully I won't have to do that kind of work anymore.
You're not proud of it. Why?
Well, I don't think entertainment should be about violence. Mm-hmm. I mean, the violence should not be the entertainment part of a movie. I think heroicism, and I think that the movement and action and tension and chase is all part of what movies have been about from the beginning. As a matter of fact, you know, I remember seeing train crashes at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago when I was a kid to play with a player piano, you know, in the old 1910 street. But I think that that films can be, if there's going to be violence in films, it should not be fluffed up. It shouldn't be cartoonish. Because when people get shot, they die. And I don't think that we should have films that use these kinds of scenes as a way to handle human behavior. It'd be better if people could talk things through. But if you're going to depict it, don't pamper it.
I noticed that you've worked a number of times with Tommy Lee Jones and also with Steven Seagal. What do you get as a director when you work with an actor over time in one movie after another?
Well, you get trust and you get great collaboration, which is what I need. I mean, the more people who have good ideas, the better I am as a director and the better the movie's going to be. And some people don't like that. They create the script or they've inherited a script, they don't want to change it. They envision it. They just want to have their own vision. And I think I feel comfortable enough about the process that I sort of set a tone and set a point of view about what the scene is about. And then work with people to try to get them to give me the best they can for it.
How has being a cameraman helped you as a director?
Well, people come to directing from all kinds of points of view. And some are writers, some are actors, some are producers, some are art directors. And I feel coming from the camera is great because the analogy that I've been using is that, you know, it's like conducting a symphony without being able to read music.
Hmm.
And there are great directors who don't come from this background. Very few actually come from the camera. But some people who, for example, Fellini was a cartoonist. He has a visual orientation. Kubrick was a still photographer. There are certain people who either acquire it, you know, or have it to begin with.
Well, I thank you very much, Andrew Davis, for joining us today on Fresh Air and talking to us about your movies.
Thank you. It was nice talking to you.
Film director Andrew Davis. The Fugitive has been nominated for 7 Academy Awards and has just come out on videotape. Davis's next film will be a comedy called Steal Big, Steal Little. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up, and Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about some of the stories they'll be covering today. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Marty. We'll be hearing today about shootings in Maputo, Tswana, by the Tswana police against some white extreme rightists who were opposed to participation in the South African election. Also, historian Merle Goldman on the appeal by Chinese dissidents to the Chinese government today for human rights. Cheryl Duvall on an interesting Republican congressional primary in Illinois. And we'll be concluding our week-long series on health care reform proposals. Linda Wertheimer talks with Senator John D. Rockefeller of West Virginia about his proposal. And she'll also wrap up with our reporter Joanne Silberner all the different health care reform proposals that are out on the table.
Robert, thanks. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Orson Welles wanted to film a version of Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, but never completed it. Francis Ford Coppola used the novella about good confronting evil as inspiration for his Vietnam War epic, Apocalypse Now, with Marlon Brando playing the mad jungle dweller, Kurtz. But the first true screen adaptation of Conrad's story comes this Sunday on the TNT cable network, with a telemovie starring John Malkovich and Tim Roth, directed by Nicholas Roeg. TV critic David Bean Cooley has this review.
Here's the really weird thing about this version of Heart of Darkness. You expect, or at least I did, that the best things about it are going to be the photography and John Malkovich. The photography, because Nicholas Roeg did such great visual work in Don't Look Now and The Man Who Fell to Earth. And Malkovich, because ever since I saw him in True West on American Playhouse 10 years ago, he's dazzled me with his talent. The photography is wonderful, up to a point. Rogue shot the whole movie on location and in sequence, heading deeper and deeper into the actual jungles and waterways of Belize. And the teleplay by Benedict Fitzgerald builds the suspense beautifully, as we listen to the thoughts of Marlowe as he gets closer and closer to the mysterious, dangerous, power-mad Kurtz. Marlowe is played by Tim Roth, who was the undercover cop in Reservoir Dogs and killer Charlie Starkweather in TV's Murder in the Heartland. He's excellent here, quiet, skeptical, world-weary, and the script gives him the chance to make some of Conrad's best and brightest observations. Here, while other sailors are playing a dice game, he's giving his own thoughts about conquering heroes.
Romans were conquerors. Is that all you need? It's brute force. Nothing to boast about. It's just robbery with violence. Aggravated murder on a great scale. The conquest of the earth mostly means the taking it away from those with different skin tone. Slightly flatter noses than ourselves. Not a pretty thing when you look into it too deeply.
But when the telemovie finally gets to the heart of the Heart of Darkness, when Marlowe meets Kurtz face to face after hunting him throughout most of the story, the whole thing starts to lose steam. Instead of being moody and dark, the photography captures their conversations in a series of static two-shots. And Malkovich, in playing this particular role, has decided that less is more. So instead of acting mad, he underacts, like a jungle-bound CPA.
Don't you find it surprising and glorious that the only things that remain of us, after all our strivings, carry the same traces? Hyenas, smellers of death.
When Malkovich says Kurtz's famous final line, "The horror, the horror," his choice of quiet speech is justified. Conrad, in the original story, described Kurtz's delivery of that line as a cry that was no more than a breath. But Malkovich, I think, took that one description and used it as a blueprint for the entire characterization, and I'm not sure it works. Instead of Marlon Brando, we get Wally Cox. But just because Malkovich isn't great, that doesn't mean he isn't good. Heart of Darkness is a lot more of a success than a failure. And even with a climax that doesn't work as well as it should, it tells a strong and scary story and tells it with a talented cast and crew. The Amy Fisher story, it's not. And given the usual subjects for network telemovies these days, that in itself is cause for celebration.
David Biancooley is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy with Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Marty Moskowain. Terry Gross will be back on Monday.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Singer-songwriter Sam Phillips used to make Christian records. Now her secular music is on the pop charts. On the next Fresh Air, we'll meet her. Join us.
I left my conscience like a crying child. Locked the doors behind me, put the